Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First, thank you to Dr. May and Dr. Barnes for the invitation to share with you today. In 2018, I'll try to give you an update in terms of all things fluids from crystalloid to colloid and blood products. And I'll tell you now that in 2018, there's some fairly compelling data that just came out this year. So I'll show that I have no financial conflicts of interest to disclose. So the objectives of my talk today with this sophisticated audience, I won't belabor the physiology of the cardiovascular system, but I'll focus primarily on the pathophysiology of the hypotensive shock patient. I'll update you on the literature regarding the optimal choice of fluid, including crystalloid, colloids, and blood products. Be familiarized with guidelines for the use of these fluids in the management of critically ill patients, and then hopefully to take away with some current strategies in terms of how to approach the initial fluid resuscitation. In terms of the pathophysiology, the hypovolemia causes inadequate oxygen delivery and hence activates a series of homeostatic mechanisms that were initially designed to preserve perfusion to vital organs. Now, at the cellular level, hypovolemic shock will result in oxygen supply that is insufficient to meet the demand for aerobic metabolism. So thus, the cells will transition to anaerobic metabolisms, leading to the accumulation of lactic acid, which is an important biochemical value to follow, and then inorganic phosphates and oxygen radicals, as previously mentioned by other presenters. These events will then culminate in the release of damage-associated molecular patterns, which further exacerbate the systemic inflammatory response. And all these events will then lead to, finally, the failure of homeostasis, leading to cell necrosis or cell death by inflammation, apoptosis, cell death by programmed cell death, and then necrosis. Now, at the more macro level, the vasoconstriction of hypovolemic shock will result in hypoperfusion and organ damage and then multiple organ failure syndrome. There is mounting evidence in a fair number of abstracts at this Congress to demonstrate that the oxygen debt causes endotheliopathy through the systemic shedding of the glycocalyx barrier, what we commonly refer to clinically as the capillary leak syndrome. Furthermore, the way we resuscitate these patients may exacerbate the metabolic derangements. And by that, I mean perhaps the overzealous resuscitation with crystalloids, which result in dilution of red blood cells, clotting factors. The infusion of cold fluids can lead to hypothermia, therefore reduces the enzymatic activities of the clotting factors. And then excessive administration of acidic crystalloids can obviously worsen the acidosis that is already in place for these critically ill hypotensive patients. So with that as a background, what should be the principles in terms of damage control resuscitation? Well, we should avoid or correct the hypothermia, direct control of bleeding sites, perhaps consideration for delay in the initial fluid administration until definitive hemostasis is achieved, such as cases of penetrating trauma in patients who have short pre-hospital transport time. Perhaps we should consider minimizing crystalloid infusion, especially during the initial 24 hours or 6 hours, keeping it maybe less than 3 liters of crystalloids. I'll show you more data in terms of the massive transfusion protocol. Avoid delays in definitive surgical interventions. Minimize imbalances in the plasma, platelets, and red cell transfusions. And then as you're resuscitating these patients, perhaps consider other laboratory measures to more specifically target your therapy. And as many of us are caring more and more for older patients who are on oral anticoagulation, perhaps reversal of these anticoagulant agent in the early phase of your resuscitation, and then correct the excessive fibrinolysis. Is there such thing as an ideal fluid for the initial management? The characteristics for this fluid ought to be they provide predictable and sustained increase in intravascular volume. It should have the chemical composition similar to that of extracellular fluid. It should be metabolized completely and excreted without any accumulation in tissues. It should have minimal or no adverse metabolic or systemic effects. It should be cost effective and practical. And ideally, it should have some robust data to improve patient outcomes. Well, in 2018, I would argue that such fluid remains elusive still. Here in the picture in the two tables, just illustrate the points of the variety of colloids and crystalloids. And as you can see, the number of colloids out there on the market is quite numerous. Usually when you see more and more products, that means there's perhaps very little evidence to support the use of these agents. So let's go into the data. This is a trial called CRYSTAL trial that was published in JAMA in 2013, so about 5 years ago now. It was a multi-center randomized open label trial involving almost 3,000 patients with sepsis, trauma, and hypovolemic shock. And the patients were randomized into two groups, the colloid, which consists of gelatins, dextrin, hydroxyethyl starch, or albumin, or the crystalloid group, which received isotonic, hypotonic, or lactated ringers. And the primary outcome was mortality at 28 days. The secondary outcomes included 90-day mortality, days alive without the need for renal replacement therapy, the need for mechanical ventilation, or vasopressor support. Illustrated on your right hand, there is a figure of the mortality, and as you can see, the two groups had pretty similar in terms of mortality, comparing crystalloids versus colloid therapy. So in this CRYSTAL trial, in critically ill patients with hypovolemia, the use of colloid versus crystalloid did not, unfortunately, result in a 28-day mortality difference, regardless of which sort of subgroup that you look at, whether sepsis or trauma or other causes of hypovolemic shock. There was, however, a signal in the 90-day mortality that was lower in patients receiving colloid. The need for renal replacement therapy was similar between the two groups. Here in the colloid group, the patients had more days without mechanical ventilation and more days alive without vasopressor support. So that was the CRYSTAL trial. This is a subgroup analysis of the patient population in the CRYSTAL trial. This was published in the British Medical Journal last year. It included patients who had a pulmonary artery catheter that had severe hypovolemic shock. The trial had 220 patients, 103 received crystalloids, and 117 received colloid. As you can imagine, the outcomes here, the median volume in the colloid group had a little bit less of 2.5 liters of fluid compared to the patients who received crystalloid at 3.5. Patients in the colloid arm had lower heart rate, as shown on the right upper figure there, but there were no differences in terms of hemodynamic parameters such as cardiac indexes, mean arterial pressure, lactates, or the sequential organ failure assessment scores. So in patients with severe hypovolemic shock, colloid and crystalloid resuscitation resulted in similar hemodynamic outcomes. The colloid group appeared to have lower in terms of their volume of resuscitation. This is a recent trial published this year in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at the use of balanced crystalloid versus saline in critically ill patients. And I'll just bring your attention to one of the co-authors on the paper, which is our moderator, Dr. May, from the Vanderbilt Medical Center then. It's a single institution pragmatic cluster randomized trial involving in five ICUs at their institution. This is a large study, almost 16,000 patients in the trial. They compare the use of saline versus the more balanced crystalloids, whether lactated ringers or plasma light A, based on their ICU location. The primary outcome for this trial was 30-day major adverse kidney event. So this is a composite outcome, including death from any cause, new renal replacement therapy, or persistent renal dysfunction, defined as your creatinine level greater than 200% of baseline. The in-hospital 30-day mortality, there was a statistical trend to a significance with the balanced crystalloid at 10% and the saline group at a little more than 11%. As shown in this table over here, you see the major adverse kidney event achieving statistical significance there. And again, that's a composite outcome. About this trial was a single institutional trial. Patients were grouped according to hospital locations, raising the questions of sort of generalizability for these patients. It is a surrogate outcome. The variables are biochemical and physiologic, perhaps not translatable to other patient-centered outcomes. And the composite outcomes were used because it is a useful index for trials with low event rates, but it is subject to other confounding factors. Now, suffice it to say, if you look at all the subgroup of patients in this trial, most of them had a trend to a favorable outcome in the balanced crystalloids compared to saline, with the exception of the cardiac patient and the patient who sustained traumatic brain injury. So that was the balanced crystalloid versus saline trial. Looking at the amount of fluid in terms of resuscitating patients, again, this trial was published in the New England Journal this year, looking at restrictive versus liberal fluid therapy for major abdominal surgery. It's a pragmatic international trial randomizing patients who were undergoing major abdominal surgeries, who were at high risk for perioperative complications. Large study, 3,000 patients were randomized to either restrictive versus a liberal fluid regimen within the first 24 hours post-op. So as by design, the restrictive group received about 3.7 liters in the first 24 hours compared to those in the liberal group who received almost twice the amount of fluid at 6 liters. The primary outcome for this trial was disability-free survival at 1 year, so a fairly long follow-up. Secondary outcomes include 30-day acute kidney injuries, 90-day of renal replacement therapy, and then a composite outcome including septic complication, surgical site infections, or death. And as shown in this table over here, as you can see, the composite index, including surgical, the incidence of surgical site infection, renal replacement therapy favored the restrictive group. The patients who received less fluid tended to do better in terms of their acute kidney injury and renal replacement therapy. So in this trial, the authors demonstrated that restrictive fluid regimen was not associated with a higher rate of disability-free survival. Patients in the restrictive group of fluid therapy had a higher incidence of acute kidney injury. Patients in the restrictive group also had a slight increase in surgical site infection and the need for renal replacement therapy. Majority of these procedures included esophageal, gastric, and colorectal procedures, and half of them were open procedures. These patients had significant comorbidities. So it appears that patients with a more targeted restrictive therapy tended to do better in terms of their acute kidney injury and renal replacement therapy. there was no difference in mortalities again. So I'm just going to summarize in terms of colloid versus crystalloid resuscitation. The SAFE trial, published in 2004, comparing 4% albumin versus saline. Albumin achieved a small decrease in heart rate, but no difference in mortality, except in the severely septic patients. The CHEST study, comparing hydroxyethyl starch with saline, in 2012, among the various hemodynamic targets, hydroxyethyl starch led only to a higher CVP. Not sure what to make of that. The 6S trial, published in 2012, comparing hydroxyethyl starch with lactated ringers, the hemodynamic profiles were essentially similar between the two groups. The Albios trial, comparing 20% albumin with saline, published in 2014, albumin administration in patients with severe sepsis resulted in lower heart rate and shorter duration for vasopressor support. The CRYSTAL trial I alluded to earlier, comparing colloids versus crystalloid, colloids achieve lower heart rate and maybe more ventilator-free days. So that's the story behind colloid versus crystalloids. Let's go over to a blood and blood product in 2018. This is a trial by Holcomb and colleagues, published in JAMA about 3 years ago, looking at the use of 1:1:1 ratio, comparing to 1:1:2 ratio. It's a pragmatic phase 3 multi-site randomized trial in North America, involving 12 level 1 trauma centers, looking at the safety and effectiveness of these ratios for plasma, platelets, and RBC, red blood cells. There were 680 patients, severely injured patients arriving directly from the scene. The outcomes as illustrated in the on the right-hand upper portion, 24-hour mortality and 30-day mortality. There were no statistical differences between the two groups, comparing to 1:1:1 versus 1:1:2. More patients in the 1:1:1 group achieve hemostasis, shown in that red arrow there, statistically significant, with fewer of them dying from exsanguination in the first 24 hours. Patient in the 1:1:1 arm received more plasma and platelets, that's by design, and there were no safety differences between the two groups. Now, this is a fairly new study published recently in the New England Journal looking at the use of pre-hospital administration of plasma. It's a PEMPA trial. It's a pragmatic multi-center phase 3 cluster randomized superiority trial comparing standard of care versus the plasma during air transport. The primary outcome was 30-day mortality. There were a little more than 500 patients in this trial. 230 received plasma and 271 received standard of care. It's illustrated there, the patients in the plasma group had higher survival, less mortality, that achieved statistical significance. Plasma arm had lower median level of prothrombin time, and there were no differences in terms of the incidence of multiple organ failure, acute lung injury, ARDS, nosocomial infection, or transfusion-related reactions. Looking at the use of a hemoglobin threshold in burn patients, this is a prospective multicenter trial published last year in the Annals of Surgery. 18 burn centers randomizing patients to a restrictive group versus a liberal with a hemoglobin threshold of 10 to 11 for a fairly significant burn size. 345 patients who sustained more than 20% total body surface area burns. The outcomes, restrictive group received less transfusion, and that's by design. There were no differences in terms of the incidence of bloodstream infection, organ dysfunction, ventilator days, or time to wound healing. There were no differences in terms of mortality. So it appears that patients who had a more restrictive target of hemoglobin tended to do this as well. So with all that data in mind, what should our resuscitation strategy be going forward? Our goal ought to be to restore intravascular volume, especially after the source control. Prevention and reduction of escalating oxygen debt, all the pathophysiology that entail from that. Damage control resuscitation, we also consider massive transfusion protocols, the use of products to attenuate acute coagulopathy and reverse the physiologic derangements. Perhaps we should consider a relatively hypotensive target with systolic blood pressure in the 90 to 100 range, especially during before our source control. Maybe consider the use of pharmaceutical adjuncts in the next phase of your resuscitation, more judicious use of volume administration, and more sort of perfusion-targeted endpoints such as lactate or other measures that you use at your institution, and the use of perhaps more balanced solutions. This is a guideline that was put forward by the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma, published last year in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery. The group suggested the development and implementation of a massive transfusion damage control resuscitation protocol, the management of severely injured trauma, not to be based on the multi-professional input. The targeting for a higher ratio of both plasma to red blood cells and platelet to red blood cells at the 1-to-1 ratio. So the massive transfusion pack should consist of 6 units of plasma, 6 of red blood cells, and 1 apheresis units of platelet. They had no specific recommendations for or against the use of factor 7A, since there were no improvements in all-cause mortality, but possibly reduce the need for massive transfusion. And then they had a conditional recommendation for the use of TXAs as a hemostatic adjunct in the in-hospital setting. So, some take-home points for your contemplation in terms of fluid resuscitation strategy. Judicious use, you ought to consider the type, the dose, the indication, and maybe more importantly, the contraindications for the type of fluid to use, the toxicity and the cost involved with this type of fluid. Should be physiology-based, the type of fluid loss and equivalent replacement for the fluid loss. Pay careful attention to the osmolarity and acid-base status of your critically ill patients. And then during the next phase, perhaps going into the 48 to 72 hours, pay close attention to the cumulative fluid balances. Maybe consider the early use of catecholamines for the concomitant treatment of shock. The temporal considerations, the post-resuscitation interstitial edema is important, so pay careful attention to that. Adjunct to guide your resuscitation beyond oliguria, other biochemical targets such as lactate. Cautious use of hypotonic maintenance fluids. Specific consideration and applications for replacement. If a patient is in hemorrhagic shock, maybe require blood and components early. Balanced crystalloids in the pragmatic use if you have that at your institution in terms of balanced crystalloids. Early use of albumin after initial crystalloids in patients with severe sepsis. Hydroxyethylstarch is not indicated in sepsis or high risk in patients with high risk for acute kidney injury. Then albumin is not indicated in patients sustaining traumatic injury. And with that, I'll close. Thanks again to Dr. May and Dr. Barnes for the invitation. Thank you very much.